Welcome to Downstream, shot from the tropical paradise that is North London. I'm so excited to be joined by Abby Martin, the host of The Empire Files, advocate, journalist, all-round anti-imperialist firebrand. We talk about Gaza, Trump, Russia, and what it was like to be politicized by the war on terror. So stay tuned for all of that. Abby Martin, welcome to Downstream. I'm so gassed to have you.
I am so thrilled to be here. Thank you so much, Ash. I'm a huge fan.
So I suppose the first thing that I wanted to ask you is that as a Brit, when you're looking at American culture, particularly when you're young, it just seems so optimistic. It's got this can-do attitude. And that's the impression that we got from watching all of your romantic comedies when, you know, we were like 8 or 9 years old. And then something really happened around the war on terror where that sunny optimism became, to my eyes, quite insular, paranoid, thin-skinned. So as a genuine full-time Yank, from your vantage point, how did your sense of what it meant to be American change during the war on terror?
Yeah, I think my story is pretty commonplace with a lot of young Americans that were radicalized through 9/11 and subsequently the Iraq War. I was a senior in high school when 9/11 happened. I was just completely vapid in my own bubble. I grew up kind of in this staunch Democratic Party family who the new Democrats. So we were like, you know, just followed in line with the Clintonites, not really understanding why we supported the death penalty or we were, you know, harsh on immigration. But that's just what we were told, you know, the Democratic Party stood for at the time. So, you know, I was living in the suburbs, this kind of white flight 20 minutes away from the Bay Area in Oakland, California, or in Pleasanton, but 20 minutes away from Oakland. And I was just completely shrouded in my own just ignorance, essentially. I mean, I didn't even know really what Palestine was. I mean, it just really goes to show you how much of a failure our education system is. But when 9/11 happened, it just shook all of our worlds. I mean, I went into college and I started just vociferously reading. I remember I read Blowback from Chalmers Johnson, and I was just like taken aback at how insane the presence of our US military was around the world. I remember when the Iraq War happened, when Operation Iraqi Freedom, the bombing of Baghdad, I was sitting in the lunch hall, like at San Diego State, which San Diego has like the largest concentration of military bases in the entire country. So I was just surrounded by like, you know, armored, like servicemen, like fucking in uniform. And they were just cheering as if it was a video game. And I mean, something inside me just was, I mean, my stomach was just sick. I remember calling my mom. I was like, did Saddam do something? I was like what the hell happened? We just switched from 9/11 to Iraq, and it just made no sense to me. But, you know, even though I felt like I was really like alone, and it really took me a long time to find my crew and to, you know, galvanize anti-war activism in that city. I felt like, you know, looking back on it, I mean, it was a time of just tumultuous uprooting of that kind of American ignorance for millions of young people at the time that just kind of got shook to their core, that, you know, really looking at 9/11, how did something like this happen? What were we doing around the world to cause something like this? And then also, why the hell did we go off on this murderous rampage as a result?
What were the kinds of media sources that you were engaging with, which were able to, you know, kind of feed and nourish this little seed of anti-imperialism?
You know, at the time I was, it's crazy. There really were not many alternative media sources online at the time. It was like either conspiracy sites like InfoWars that really took you down like really crazy rabbit holes. But I remember awakening to the fact that the media was complicit. And that was like a huge shock to my system too. Like, because at first I just blamed Bush. Bush is evil incarnate. You know, we need to do everything that we can to stop the Republicans. And then it pivoted over to the Democrats when I was like, wait, why is Nancy Pelosi saying impeachment's off the table? Why are the Democrats doing this? This makes no sense. And then I kind of had this realization that, wait, the media is actually serving as, you know, it's serving the ruling class. It's putting out this propaganda to prop up these myths and to push this foreign policy. And it's complicit. And so I just kind of paved my own way to create my own media agency, which was Media Roots, 25 years ago, because I was like, there's no way that I could actually do anti-war activism without having a platform to push these ideas through, because I'm not just going to stand out on the street corner handing out flyers. I need to create something that's counter to this corporate media hegemony. So it kind of like all snowballed into realizing the entire system props up itself, and everyone is a player in the game. And that's what led my advocacy through citizen journalism and being an advocacy journalist, wearing my bias on my sleeve and pushing for the issues that I care about, which is, you know, anti-imperialism and US foreign policy. But at the time, there was really not much out there, Ash. I mean, it was really just books and literature that I dove into when I was in college.
You mentioned that your parents were sort of New Democrats, Clintonite. You know, the social problems are very bad, but the causes are very good. So when you went on your journey of politicization, did your parents come along with you for any of it? Or was there just a divergence at that point?
Amazingly, my mom has been with me every step of the way. She is hardcore radical leftist. She says all the time, she's just like, if you're not right on Palestine, I don't want to hear what you have to say. She's hardcore. She's wearing her keffiyeh every day, free Gaza sweatshirt. I mean, she's balls to the wall now. But yeah, she came on the journey with me, I would say. My brother as well. My brother was a little bit more red-pilled in the conspiracy land, but he's done incredible work. We have a podcast together now. And my dad is more conservative-minded, but he's still like, it's still like very logical. He just kind of sits back and he's like, I still don't understand why we can't talk to other world leaders. Like why he doesn't really understand how absurd, you know, US foreign policy is. So even though he's a little bit more conservative, he still understands just how fundamentally backwards it is that we're the world's empire and we are, you know, the global bully. So he's getting there.
I mean, it sounds like your mom should meet my mom because they'd get on like a house on fire. You mentioned the dearth of good media when you were becoming politicized and, you know, your brother perhaps got a little bit more red-pilled. So what's the difference and how can you tell the difference between high quality information that exposes conspiracies and lower quality information, which ends up promoting conspiracies?
I mean, that's a good question, because with the algorithmically driven like 24-hour news cycle, you have so many content creators feeding off of that content and media generation that just, it's so superficialized and it just actually takes the most low-grade conspiracies and they peddle them without any thinking at all and how it actually is impacting large swaths of people. And I would say that that's a huge problem because it's just completely entertainment-driven. And so we've turned what was a big problem when you look at like InfoWars and how, you know, critical thinking and deep state critiques of power that were historically like left wing critiques of things like, you know, an apparatus like the deep state or a government that, you know, is in power no matter what political party switches out. But then it's turned into like a partisan prism. But now it's so hard to tell, Ash, and it's so low grade and so awful because it's just taken over everything. And now you have any sort of critiques of those ideas, and it's now just pivoted over to Republicanism, which is just so bizarre to me. It's like you can't question state narratives or you know, US foreign policy without being called like a Trumpite or a conspiracy theorist. And it's just another pejorative, I think, that tamps down on critical thinking. But, you know, I just tell people, like, you have to have a critical mind. I mean, we have to be media literate. We have to understand who's putting out the stories and what mechanisms are behind the institutions that are putting out the stories. And that's speaking with corporate media and the six corporations that control them, or just people who are content creators on TikTok and Instagram that are just trying to get clicks and just want to put out whatever the hell they want to based on nothing. Just, I mean, and so we have to really be critically minded and take a step back and look at where are we actually getting this information from and who's generating it and for what purpose.
Just to play devil's advocate for a minute, I mean, not that the devil necessarily needs an advocate, but he's going to get one anyway. There are people who would say that if you're pursuing advocacy journalism, so if you're a political person, as well as being a journalist, that you've got an inherent tendency not to be skeptical enough of your own position, because there are certain things that you want to be true because they reflect your political values or your worldview. How would you respond to those critics of advocacy journalism?
Well, I think the concept of neutrality has been hammered into the head of media consumers and just journalists who go through the institutions of J school. And I would say, look, as an advocacy journalist, I'm open about my bias. And especially entering into when I worked for state-funded media, I mean, I circumvent the bias. I'm very clear about what bias I'm entering into. And I think that that's refreshing because everyone has an opinion, Ash, and that includes journalists who enter into corporate media. And the opinions are that they believe in the reigning orthodoxy of capitalism and U.S. empire. Otherwise, you wouldn't be able to get jobs in these institutions. They just couch their opinions into appeal to authority with think tanks and politicians and, you know, military institutions that dictate what they can kind of hide their opinions behind. And so I think that that's much more insidious. But, you know, I welcome dissenting views. I love sitting down and talking to people who vote for Trump. I mean, I feel like I can relate to anyone on a human level. I can see where these narratives are coming from. But I just am open about where I'm coming from because I want people to understand and I want to be super clear about where I'm coming from instead of hiding it and trying to pretend like I'm, you know, this moral authority figure where I'm, you know, we have to tell both sides of every story. And even if that means, you know, citing the Israeli military or the Palestinians who are being slaughtered by them, I mean, it's just so convoluting, unnecessarily so, when not every story has to have both equal sides. That's just not the way history and reality work.
Would you say that there are certain opinions which, for reasons of political convenience, are simply unsayable in American media?
100%. Look at the way American media works. I mean, just the fact that the system exists to prop up itself. So when you have people like me, who, I mean, are critics of capitalism, very harsh critics of U.S. imperialism, I mean, you don't exist and you can't survive in these institutions. And so you have to pave your own way. And the system exists to just tamp down and suppress voices like mine. So you have several ways to just discredit and character assassinate people like me. I mean, you have Wikipedia, which exists to just reference corporate media attacks. And corporate media has attacked me quite a bit, saying I'm a Russian agent, I'm a conspiracy theorist, and I'm an anti-Semite, of course, because of my viewpoints that run counter to what corporate media exists to do. I mean, if you look at the way U.S. empire is propped up and how corporate media acts as an arm of our foreign policy, all of our enemies and allies, I mean, it's just so by the playbook. I mean, Palestine is a perfect example of how egregious this narrative plays out, where one side is just blanketly painted as the heroic people and the other side are the villainous terrorists. And so if you run counter to that, I think it's the most extreme example because I've talked to many of my colleagues in media and they've said, this is just simply a third rail issue. You cannot talk about Palestine. You cannot talk about a free Palestine, and you have to toe the line if you want to keep your job. It's sick and it's disgusting. And I mean, for me, it's like, I wouldn't be able to do my job if I wasn't able to be honest about what I see. And it's just been so egregiously laid out and laid bare over the last 5 months, I think, that people are finally starting to wake up. But I mean, you see people like resigning, you see people protesting from within these news agencies saying the dehumanization of Palestinians is too much for me to handle, even though they are kind of willing agents in these things and they are believers in the system to a certain extent. But it gets to a certain point, Ash, where even those people think it's gone too far. But I would say Palestine is certainly the biggest third rail issue. But a lot of things about U.S. foreign policy are. I mean, if you sympathize with, you know, Cuba or Venezuela, I mean, whatever's at the receiving end of U.S. sanctions, brutality, or warfare, we all see how it plays out. You have to condemn Saddam, right? You have to condemn Gaddafi. You have to condemn Hamas. if you want to say anything about the rights of the people that are living under the boot of US empire and being subjugated by our policies.
Was there ever a moment where perhaps you felt a little bit tempted to join up with corporate media and try to change it from within?
No, I didn't. I always knew that I would never be welcomed in corporate media. I mean, that's why I started off as an activist, and that was always in my heart. And I know that that flies in the face of what you're told is this professional journalism outfit that you have to, you know, put forward to work at these agencies. I was at Occupy Wall Street. I was kind of the liaison for coverage there, doing videos of the brutality of the Oakland police and RT, this Russian news agency. Back then, no one knew what the hell it was really, other than the fact that there was a foreign news outlet that was covering the protests seriously. And so we didn't care. We just said, this is great. Like, finally, someone's giving us the coverage that we deserve and putting our voices out there and covering social movements with a fair lens. So I think that I always knew that, you know, cynically or not, institutions like RT that were exploiting the divisions in American society and the failures of corporate media for not doing the basic job of holding power to account, I knew that that was the only avenue to really cover the stories that I wanted to cover. Of course, real stories are covered. Great investigative reports are done throughout corporate media, but it's a tough slog. And I think that when you look and pivot to something like US foreign policy, it's simply and virtually non-existent. And so my passion always being exposing the US empire and an advocate against or fighter against US imperialism, I knew that I would never have a chance in those agencies. And I knew that RT and subsequently Telesaur and now going completely independent for the last 6 years, I knew that that was really the only option I had, Ash, especially in this constriction that we see over time of media, the consolidation of media, and especially the algorithms that are just driving out and suppressing the left more and more. So it's really a dark future for those of us who want to keep telling these stories.
I want to talk more about RT in a minute, but just to go back to activism for a second, one of the things that activism taught me is that cops lie. And I've taken that into my journalistic practice. They might not lie about everything, but they'll lie about anything. And I've taken that skepticism into the journalistic work that I do. So when the police release a statement about what went on, who did what I've learned is to read it against the grain rather than going with the grain. So what did you learn from activism that you've taken with you into your journalistic practice?
It's a great question. I mean, I think I learned just how suppressed activism is in a fair way. It's painted kind of with broad brush. It's generalized a lot. I think, especially my experience in Occupy Wall Street and the way that it was demonized by the corporate media and ridiculed. I mean, there's far too many stories to retell about how just ludicrous the coverage was, just painting these protesters as just like juvenile and, you know, had no goals in mind. And they would just pick sound bites from the most crazy sounding people and generalize the entire movement. And I think that was just so infuriating because it's like, look, I mean, these people are, you know, we were pushed to the brink where, you know, it was on the heels of the housing collapse and people had no idea what to do. This was several years into the Obama administration, and Obama came in after this horrific, tumultuous period during Bush where we were embroiled in all of these wars. And Obama said he was going to change it, right? He was going to shut down Guantanamo Bay. He was going to end the endless wars. And he just didn't do anything that he set his sights to do. And so I think there was this groundswell of people who just didn't know what else to do, especially with this economic collapse that we were facing. And the way that the corporate media painted it was just disgusting. So I think I learned and I was instructed by the voices that I was surrounded by that I wanted to uplift those voices that never had a chance to be heard or seen in corporate media. I mean, corporate media is subsidized by the very institutions that we are trying to expose: banks, defense contractors, the oil giants. It's kind of cartoonish when you look at it. I mean, of course, corporate media is not going to cover social movements fairly and uplift the voices of the people who are trying to expose who subsidizes them. So I think that was my biggest takeaway is like, I want to be a people's journalist. I want to tell these stories. I want to uplift these narratives that will never be told.
Thinking about the distinction between corporate media and state media, someone might say that, sure, corporate media isn't perfect, but at least you don't have a government dictating what the editorial line should be.
I mean, that's what our government is. Our government is a capitalist entity that is essentially just different facets of industries. So, I mean, our government essentially is just defense contractors, you know, it's people in suits run by defense contractors. And so corporate media is an extension of what U.S. capitalism and the U.S. government is. So even though it's a little bit more complicated when you look at the structure of how it all works, I would argue, yeah, I mean, of course, state media, it can be cartoonish. I mean, look at how Russia Today has metamorphized after Trump's election. It's essentially become like de facto Trump news network when, you know, at the time when I joined, it was much more fair. I mean, it just let people do really what they wanted as long as they were exposing the divisions and exploiting those divisions. That's what RT hired people like me to do. But there was no dictates from above, as amazing as it may sound. I mean, there was an infamous moment where I spoke out against the Crimea incursion on RT and denounced the coverage of the network itself. And I went to my boss that morning. I wasn't trying to pull, you know, career suicide by doing it on air without anyone knowing. I went to my boss that morning and I said, I'm going to read this statement. And if you don't allow me to read this statement on air, I'm going to walk out and quit. And he was just like, okay. I mean, and I did. And, you know, it caused this huge, you know, it caused this huge upset at the network. I think half of the people at the top thought it was good that I showed that I had editorial freedom and subsequently did continue to speak out against Russia. And half of the other people at the network were like, why is she still hired? She didn't toe the line. But I think that was a really important moment to just kind of show other people that just thought of RT as this cartoonish propaganda network that no, you can risk your career to pave editorial freedom. I mean, look at someone like Cenk Uygur on MSNBC. He was fired for criticizing the Iraq war. Phil Donahue, fired for criticizing the Iraq war. So even though you can look at the structure of funding and say, yeah, it's not just dictated by government officials, it actually acts essentially the same as a de facto government agency. And when you divert from that, you can be punished and you will be fired. And, you know, they might have fired me if I didn't cause this huge news moment around the world and kind of make it so they couldn't fire me. But, you know, they punished me in other ways. But I think I did show that if you put your job on the line and you feel like you want to put forward, you know, moral principles and risk your job for that, you can do things that you might not think that you can do. And that's what I think I proved at RT that I paved my own editorial freedom and I continue to do so.
Do you want to hear something completely nuts about British media?
Yeah.
So there's this newsletter. It goes out every day. It's called Playbook and it's sent out by Politico. And it's got a rundown of everything that's going on in Westminster. So what's leading the day, what's happening in Parliament, who's going to be on the media round. And it really is a useful resource, particularly if you work in political media. But it's sponsored and who's sponsoring it can change from day to day. But it's been people like BAE Systems, it's been Palantir, it's been BP. And it's a bit like, you know, Noam Chomsky couldn't have predicted it any better, that the most prestigious and well-regarded rundown of Westminster politics that goes into every single journalist's inbox has been brought to you by Palantir, BP and BAE Systems. But if you talk to other journalists about it, particularly if they work in Westminster journalism, what we call the lobby, they'll look at you like you're completely batshit.
It's just so normalized, right? It's like, well, yeah, how else are we supposed to survive if we're not funded by these massive corporations? It's like, what? I mean, I remember when that happened and I was invited. I was this anti-Russian hero for a day until I debunked all of the narrative. I was invited on NPR. I was invited on Piers Morgan. And I just kept bringing up their funding structures and what their networks had done. And so I didn't fall in line with the narrative that they wanted me to play along with, which is, you know, denouncing the network and denouncing Russia and all of that. And so it just, I became quickly, you know, cast aside very quickly. But it was just so funny. I was like, you're no different, really. I mean, let's look at what you did during the lead up to the Iraq war. Let's look at how NPR is funded. I mean, you guys get grants from BP. How are you supposed to tell the truth about the BP oil spill? So it was just so amazing when you kind of just pit everything against each other and everything is so problematic. And for me, it's like, yeah, I mean, RT is funded by Russia. And of course, you're not going to get the truth about Russia watching RT. But I want to know what RT is saying. I want to know what Putin is saying about Ukraine. So when we censor and when we pull down all of RT's content, we're infantilized. I mean, censorship is infantilizing. I want to know what these countries are saying so I can make up my own mind. I don't want things to be dictated to me. And I don't want anything to be curated. I don't want my reality to be curated by tech giants thinking that they know what's best for me.
Do you have a suspicion of what I'd call fact-checking media? So the institutions and the journalists who set themselves up as fact-checkers and are the self-appointed regulators of disinformation.
Oh my God, yeah. I mean, I think it was the Atlantic Council, which is another think tank funded by defense contractors, had this agency or an arm of like Hamilton 68 dashboard. And that was their premier fact-checking agency that was going around deciding and determining what was disinformation and what was valid on Twitter. And they were just purging in mass, like Chavista accounts and pro-Palestine accounts and just like, I mean, accounts that literally just ran contrary to like US foreign policy narratives. And then they all just said that they were Russian bots. I mean, it was just so cartoonishly done. And it's like, who is behind this fact-checking agency? It's just like, you just can't make this shit up, that it's just some think tank on the Hill that's funded by like weapons contractors. So yeah, I mean, I have huge suspicions of any institution that is deeming what is truth and what is not, and what is a Russian bot and what is not. And it's, you know, you really have to look at like, who are these people? Who are they funded by? And what is, what's really behind all of this? And, you know, it always kind of comes down to the same thing. It's just, again, censorship to prop up the ruling class and the ruling class narratives. And that's what we're seeing more and more, especially in the aftermath of the huge crackdown on so-called Russian media, right? Russian state media and Russian funded media and Russian bots. It really was just, it's just everything. I mean, you see Nancy Pelosi still calling like ceasefire protests Kremlin funded. I mean, these people live in a completely alternate reality and it's just dumbfounding. You saw her calling Code Pink activists funded by China. It's like, I mean, I just can't wrap my mind around the fact that they actually are that detached that they can't even fathom the fact that Black Lives Matter was completely an organic upswell against the brutality of our police and this, you know, the largest incarceration rates in America and in the world. I mean, and they can't wrap their mind around the fact that no, Gen Z is taking to the streets in droves because of this horrific genocidal onslaught. No, it has to be the Kremlin. It has to be China propping this up. It's just unbelievable, Ash, that this is where we are in the political discourse.
To go back to Russia today for just a second, you mentioned that there's been quite a big transformation in terms of editorial output. So you went from having a relative degree of autonomy where someone like you could go out and denounce the channel and denounce Russia's invasion of Crimea. And now the tenor of coverage is very, very, very different. Like, it may as well be Putin's personal TikTok. It's very much geared towards supporting his government. So does that suggest that there is an inherent weakness of any state-run media that when the firewall between government and editorial output needs to collapse, it simply will? And that's a difference between corporate establishment media and state-run media.
Well, I think they're, yeah, I mean, like I said, like corporate media, you kind of have like willing agents of empire who just believe in the orthodoxy of the system and capitalism and all of that. And so it's, you have less of a risk for people to be running contrary to the narratives that the corporate media expects them to do. But with state media, especially with an institution like RT, they were plucking at people who were just simply, they couldn't control. I mean, and that's why they liked people like me and Chris Hedges and, you know, Jesse Ventura and Lee Camp, because we were outside of the box thinkers in American culture. But that meant also that we were independent thinkers, that we wouldn't just fall in line with whatever Russia was telling us to do. So yes, I think that, you know, it's a little bit more haywire because you can control them less, but I think over time, you're right. I mean, when shit hits the fan and when Russia actually does this full scale invasion of Ukraine, I mean, none of us would have continued to work there anyway. So I think that you saw like a pretty severe locking down, and they just started to turn to journalists who they knew would completely toe the line with no question whatsoever. And so they plucked up a couple of willing Americans who would move to Moscow and be the American face of the network during this horrific invasion of Ukraine. But yeah, I think that they would never have allowed anyone like us to continue working there, because A, I would never work for RT, you know, when they're doing this kind of shit. But also it's just, yeah, they wouldn't be able to control people that they initially were attracted to for that very reason, because we simply couldn't be controlled and we were outside of the norm, kind of the way that the orthodoxy perpetrates in American culture. So yeah, I mean, I hear what you're saying, but I still think corporate media is just, it's just so much more insidiously done, because you just simply won't have those voices be able to speak out ever. I mean, and look at when someone does, like Jasmine Hughes at the New York Times. I mean, she was forced to resign, this award-winning staff writer, for simply signing onto a letter accusing Israel of committing genocide, which is like, yeah, International Court of Justice also agrees that there's plausible cause for genocide. And then you have them just plucking up random psychopaths who are openly liking tweets and Facebook posts calling to turn Gaza into a slaughterhouse. I mean, people who have no experience writing articles at all, and they are staffed at the New York Times. I mean, this is the paper of record to basically adjudicate the atrocities on October 7th, and that paved the way for untold slaughter in Gaza. So the way that all of this works is just, it's just heinous. It really is. And so many people just have no idea. They just read the paper of record and they just cement it as fact, and they don't give it a second glance. And as we know, once these lies are perpetrated around the world, like, it doesn't matter when the truth comes out, it's too late.
One of the things that happened in the UK during the Iraq War was that the firewall between Tony Blair's government and the BBC, which is meant to be editorially independent, began to break down, because when BBC journalists said that Tony Blair's administration had knowingly sexed up the intelligence dossier, which formed part of the case for war, Alistair Campbell, Tony Blair, they brought down the sort of forces of hell upon the head of the BBC and pressured the journalist to give up the name of his source. And then the source was eventually named in other sections of the media as Dr. David Kelly. And we know now that he ended up taking his own life. So even within what we would think of as bastions of journalistic integrity, there are ways for the state to get its own way. And it will often use other sections of the media against a media outlet that isn't falling into line.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy. I just recalled the fact that, you know, it's been such an insane political era that it's like hard to even remember what happened in 2016. But in 2017... the DNI report, the Director of National Intelligence, put out a report basically accusing RT and my show specifically as fomenting radical discontent that caused Trump to win the election. I mean, my show ended 2 years before the election even happened, but it just shows how ridiculous the logic really was premised upon. I mean, that faulty logic that RT somehow helped Trump get elected instead of the abysmal failure of our political system, the disenfranchisement of American voters. I mean, the fact that like half of all eligible voters don't even participate in the system. It's just so cynical and insane. And it was just a way for them to completely, do what they've always wanted to do, which is just censor alternative views and further constrict and consolidate the narratives that they want to push. But it's just crazy. I mean, you still hear this perpetuated over and over again, that Trump was somehow put in by Putin, that Putin's news network is somehow what shaped American minds. I mean, really, how many people were even watching RT? It's just, all it did really was just expose the failures of corporate media. And that's really why they hated it. But yeah, I mean, did it really pave the way for the election? No. I mean, I think that putting up a status quo candidate who was a war hawk and just a failure. I mean, nepotism through and through. I mean, the fact that you had another Clinton being put forward and shoved down our throats and she was just the chosen one. It's like, yeah, what do you think is going to happen? But it's just crazy that there's no moment of reckoning, Ash. There's no moment of reckoning at all. Here we are with Biden and Trump again. I mean, already in 2020, they broke the record of being the two oldest candidates to ever run. And now, or 4 years later, it's an abomination that this is really where we're at. And we're running the world. So it's sick. It's
fucking... Thinking about where the establishment consensus really gets things wrong, it seems abundantly clear to me that now Putin has got the luxury of dragging out the war in Ukraine. So he can wait until maybe Trump becomes president again or Joe Biden exits the White House. And that could mean the end or a significant reduction to the military aid that America sends to Ukraine, which really is the lifeblood of the Ukrainian war effort. Do you think that there is a risk that cheerleaders in Washington and in Westminster who are saying, yes, there can be such a thing as total victory for the Ukrainian army, that perhaps they ended up encouraging the war to be dragged out to this point where the only settlement options for Zelensky are going to get worse and worse as time goes on? Because Russia's negotiating position is going to end up being stronger.
Of course. I mean, look at what Boris Johnson did. He said, you have to keep this war going. I mean, there's been so many impediments of negotiations since the war began. Of course, we know the lead up to the war, there was a lot of efforts that were stymied that could have prevented this war from happening at all. The US and the UK, partners in crime, they want the bloodshed, Ash. They want Ukrainians to be used as cannon fodder. And it's a disgusting, cynical policy. They don't care about Ukrainian lives. I mean, it's absolutely horrific when you see that they've just been used as political wedges, political tools to facilitate US hegemony. And yeah, I mean, it's going to end up where there's going to be a lot of land spared, a lot of lives lost, but also Putin's going to get a lot more of what he wanted after so many needless deaths have happened. And you already see Biden like admitting that, yeah, there's going to be a lot of territory that's ceded to Putin if we want this war to end. So what was the purpose of all of this in the first place? I mean, the weapons kept flowing, the lives kept being thrown in the meat grinder, and for what? I mean, look, I completely disagree with what Putin did. I thought he threw gasoline on a tinderbox, and it was a heinous criminal behavior. I also completely disagree with the institution of NATO and what the U.S. did to facilitate and foment this war. It's disgusting. I mean, the U.S. wants nothing but war and upset, and they do not care about peace and stability in the region at all. Look at the 2014 coup that the US was fomenting. You had Victoria Nuland just casually talking about who they're going to put in charge in Ukraine. This is what these people think of countries and lives. It's just like a chess game to them, and it's heinous and disgusting.
I want to move on just a little bit, because I know you've spent a lot of time in Gaza and in Israel. For somebody who's never been to Israel before, how would you describe the culture there? So not just the government, not just what's coming from Likud and Netanyahu. How do people every day discuss and talk about Palestinians?
Yeah, I think that people need to ask themselves why you never see Western media or pro-Israel media putting microphones in front of Israelis' faces. Why is that? Why is it that we only see pre-approved government spokespeople speaking to American and British audiences? That's because Israeli society is very, very fascist. Yes, we hear that, you know, there was socialist kibbutzes at the beginning, and I'm sure there was a lot of progressive enclaves over time in Israel. Well, a lot of leftists have been simply pushed out. To be a leftist is simply a slur, and it's in fact more dangerous than ever. You know, I spent a month in the West Bank. I interviewed hundreds of Palestinians. Not one person ever said anything remotely genocidal about Israelis. All of them just said, we just want to live and coexist side by side. We just want to live in peace. Why do they have to move on top of our villages? Why do they have to do this to us? Why do they have to bully, harass, and intimidate us? Why can't they just coexist with us? I went to Jerusalem to a place called Tolerance Square for literally like 3 hours, and the racism and vitriolic genocidal incitement against Palestinians was palpable. I mean, all I did was just go around and do man on the streets. Like I do that everywhere I go. I just like to get a snapshot of where people's minds are at. And I literally just asked Israelis, it wasn't even just Israelis, it was settlers. It was just American citizens who were there just moving to Israel. Of course, we know a lot of people just up and move, just like Netanyahu himself, who's from Philadelphia. I just simply asked them, what do you think about the situation? And you should hear the rhetoric that came out of people's mouths, knowing that they were on camera. Every single one espoused genocide or ethnic cleansing. And it was just absolutely horrific. I mean, I could not believe what I was hearing with my own eyes. One Israeli told me that they were a leftist, and they said, I just want the occupation to be more humane. And he said, leftist is a slur here in Israel. I have colleagues, David Sheen, who would go to rallies and embed himself in these fascist rallies in Tel Aviv, where you have thousands of people chanting, not just death to Arabs, but death to the leftists. Death to the leftists, because there's a saying in Israeli society that leftists are AIDS and Arabs are the common cold. You can't get rid of the common cold unless you get rid of AIDS. And that's really genuinely what they think, because they want the final solution for the Arabs. They want to expel or kill all Arabs so they could have essentially an ethno state, because they think the same thing about African Jews, whether it be Ethiopian Jews who are administered Deprovera against their will. I mean, we went to an anti-refugee rally of Eritreans, people from Sudan and Darfur who are fleeing genocide. And you had hundreds of people, not just hundreds, thousands of people who are protesting what they called infiltrators, who are Africans fleeing genocide. And I talked to several people who said that they were leftists, who said, we want to support the struggle against Africans. I'm a member of the Labor Party. These people are infiltrators. They come here with their horrible habits, and we need to expel them all, send them back to Mother Africa. It's just like, my God. I mean, the contradictions and hypocrisy of people who are immigrants settling on ethnically cleansed Palestinian land to actually say that Africans are, you know, need to go back to their country is just absolutely mind-blowing. But yes, there really is such a diminishing left in Israel. I mean, just look at the genocidal onslaught. Look at the polling. Less than 2% thought that Israel was using too much firepower in Gaza after they obliterated and decimated the entire Gaza Strip. Less than 2%. You go back to the 2014 onslaught in Gaza where 2,500 Palestinians were killed, 500 children, 95% of Israelis supported that. The open fire policy at this fortified border fence, overwhelming majority, over 90% of Israelis support that. There were some Israeli human rights advocates that tried to take that policy to the Knesset, and it was overwhelmingly, unanimously upheld that no, we can shoot to kill unarmed people who are just straying too close to this border fence that essentially just prevents them from getting back to their ancestral lands. That's how fascist Israeli society is. I hate when I see politicians just trying to denounce Netanyahu as some sort of aberration from Israeli society. No, this is the norm. This is the norm. Look at every single cabinet minister. Every single member of the Knesset is out there spewing genocide, advocating mass murder of not just Palestinians, but babies. Babies. It is sick. It is sick. And I will never forgive journalists who are towing this line and pretending like this is some sort of aberration of the Likudniks and Netanyahu's. No, this is Israel. This is Israel. This is a settler colonial state founded upon ethnic cleansing. And it only exists because of the continuous ethnic cleansing of the indigenous population. And you have to have indoctrination from cradle to grave. And you have to espouse the most horrific dehumanizing language possible to paint those people as barbaric human animals, to condone and tolerate those policies against these people for 75 plus years. So that's Israeli society. I saw it firsthand. I saw it firsthand. And people want to paint those interviews that I did. Oh, I'm trying to do a gotcha. Oh, I'm trying to pick the most crazy sounding people. No, that's Israeli society. The left is non-existent, Ash.
Something that you hear a lot about from Israel's advocates, particularly in Anglophone media, is this idea that to talk about genocide, or to use, in your words, the framing that Israel wants a final solution for Arabs, for Palestinians, that that is to throw the most traumatic historic wrong done to Jewish people back in the face of the world's only Jewish state. So how has the left in the US navigated between using realistic language for what Israel is doing and also accommodating the feelings and fears and sensitivities amongst the Jewish diaspora in the United States?
Yeah, I mean, for the longest time, we were on the defense trying to explain that it wasn't anti-Semitic to criticize policies of apartheid and occupation and slow genocide in Gaza. And it was very wrapped around the sensitivities of the Jewish diaspora. You know, the Holocaust weaponization is very strong here in the US. Activists for the longest time here have been trying to tiptoe around this language, even though Israeli ministers use it themselves. I mean, you had, before there was even the brutal blockade on Gaza, you had Israeli cabinet ministers calling it a concentration camp. So these are their words, not mine. But, you know, I think finally, Ash, with the incredible frontline communities of Jewish activists putting their bodies on the line, in the thousands, doing civil disobedience, direct actions all across the country and the world, saying, this is not in my name. It's really kind of demolished and undermined that narrative that Israel has relied upon for so long, which is admittedly to weaponize the language of anti-Semitism and use it to prevent criticism of Israel. I mean, look at an institution like the Anti-Defamation League. It's cynically used to, you know, paint to rightful rises, right, in anti-Semitic language and attacks, which is a real thing. And that's mostly caused by the right-wing rise around the world and the rise of fascism, but conflate it with pro-Palestine activism. So you see these statistics that look staggering. Oh my God, in the wake of October 7th, the rise of anti-Semitic hate crimes and attacks have risen thousands of percent. And then you look at these charts and they're literally lumping in pro-Palestine rallies or someone just spray painting Free Palestine on a bus stop. It's disgusting because anti-Semitism is a real thing and it's dire and it is on the rise. But when you're painting that with Palestine activism, it becomes so muddled and convoluted. It hurts the cause more than it helps it. And unfortunately, when you are the only Jewish state and when you're slapping the Star of David on soldiers' uniforms and flags and you're committing barbaric, heinous atrocities and celebrating them in the most depraved manner possible on TikTok and social media, I mean, that is going to fuel it more and more. But it shouldn't be up to us to have to explain away why, no, it's not anti-Semitic to criticize these policies. It should be up to Israel defenders to explain why, or people who are trying to conflate these things. No, it doesn't represent all Judaism, what Israel is doing. That's insane. So I'm sick of being on the defense. It's their fault that they've done this, and it shouldn't be up to us to have to excuse away or explain away anything. But I think Jewish activists, more than anyone, are proving that narrative false.
What did you make of Bernie Sanders's reluctance or his refusal to use the language of genocide or genocidal acts for what Israel is doing in Gaza?
Well, Ash, I really loved you putting Bernie Sanders on the spot because, look, I'm a complete disbeliever in the American political system. I have been since I was radicalized. Bernie Sanders was the first time that I was really invigorated politically, and it wasn't because of just him, even though I do think that he was very consistent, more so than any other person in Congress for the last several decades, and had a lot of good policies that he was putting forward, but it was because of the mass movement behind him. Because for the first time in my life, I saw millions of people who were young, who were energized behind his campaign, and I wanted to be a part of that. Because I felt like it was a turning point, a pivotal moment that we could really fundamentally change and awaken the masses and turn it to something potentially revolutionary beyond what Bernie Sanders represented. So I think that, you know, pivoting from that and having that incredible energy, going to the Biden administration and this status quoism, and in fact, him being more right-wing and so rigid in his old age and right-wing philosophies and Zionism, and having this genocide unfold for 5 months, and having Bernie Sanders so reluctant to call a spade, and in fact, say that it makes him queasy to even consider that this could be a genocide. Oh, we can argue about definitions later. No, we can't, because as you so aptly pointed out, Ash, it's very important to call this what it is in the term that it is, because then it actually gives other states the right to intervene and the justification to intervene, because the US isn't doing anything and its appendages aren't doing anything except propping this up. So it's very important to accurately define what are genocidal acts, so we can hold the genociders responsible and accountable for those acts. I was very disappointed in Bernie. I mean, it's really sad to have him kind of tarnish his legacy by acquiescing and kind of holding on to this notion of Zionism. I mean, let's face it, Bernie is a Zionist. And I think he is one of those politicians that I was talking about, that he wants to hold dear that notion that Netanyahu is somehow unrepresentative of Israeli society, just as liberals want to paint Trump as unrepresentative of American society when he's the most American representation we've ever had as a president. A reality star, real estate mogul, psychopath, megalomaniac. What's more American than that? That's what our country was founded on. Look at George Washington. I mean, he sold illegally Indian land that they stole. I mean, this is so American, right? So I think Bernie, it was so disappointing, Ash, and it's so disappointing, especially when you just said, you know, the economic boycott, the cultural boycott, and also, why should Americans be able to go and join a foreign army that is committing genocide? That should be illegal. That should be illegal. What, can I go join ISIS? Like, what is the difference at this point, honestly? So I want a clear-cut answer, and I want people to clearly define what line on the sand that they are on. And unfortunately, Bernie has failed us. And look, I still respect him for a lot of the things he's done. But at this point in time, look, if you're not calling this what it is, like, it's a sad way to go down, Ash. Because look, the least you can do is call for some sort of halt in the subsidizing of Israeli genocide, which I'm thankful that Bernie is leading the pack on that, but it's not enough. It's not enough. We need to isolate Israel in every way, the same way that South Africa was isolated. Otherwise, apartheid will not fall. And so a lot more needs to be done on that front, and Bernie's not doing enough.
Is that an issue particular to Bernie Sanders, or is it an issue with the electoral strategy for the left more generally? Because as someone in the movement, you can say exactly what you think. You can become a lightning rod for others. But as a senator, you've got to make alliances. You've got to win elections. You've got to, you know, not get completely done over by AIPAC. So is it a demonstration of the limits of electoral realism? Or was it a particular failure of Bernie Sanders, in your view?
It's a good question. I think both can be true because at this point in the game, Bernie Sanders has nothing to lose. He really doesn't. I think that this is a failure of personal morality and convictions. But of course, when you look at the wider problems of American electoralism, there's so many impediments that the system imposes on the left. I mean, it's simply set up so the left will fail, and then it blames the left for failing. I mean, it's quite astonishing the way that the system props itself up and disenfranchises all progressive voices in this country, and then puts a gun to our heads and says, you need to just capitulate and concede to the Democratic Party, otherwise this is your fault. So yeah, I would say it is Bernie Sanders' fault for not saying the obvious, because look, he's already lost the election. He knows where Gen Z is at. He knows where the movement rested when he went back in the Senate and is doing what he's doing. But at this point, I think that he has nothing to lose and he really needs to step it up. But at the same time, if he doesn't believe that, then yeah, I mean, that's not just him cowering to AIPAC or conforming to the system. That's just what he truly believes. And I think that just shows the limitations of Bernie Sanders as a human being, a fallible human being who doesn't have all the answers and who isn't great on foreign policy, right? And he never really was great on foreign policy. He simply was better than a lot of people.
So that brings me to a question that I've always wanted to ask you, and it's about the way the left has tried to balance its priorities in terms of foreign policy and domestic policy. Because after Corbyn stepped down as Labour Party leader, there were many people on the left who felt that we tried to do too much, right? So we tried to be radical with economic policy and we tried to be radical with foreign policy, and foreign policy is what really spooked the establishment, and that's why they took Jeremy Corbyn's head off. So we maybe should have focused ruthlessly on domestic economic policy. Do you think that such a thing is possible? Can the left succeed without taking on foreign policy?
No, because we are an empire. We are the most destructive, massive military empire that the world has ever seen. And unless we confront that head on, Ash, I would argue that the left doesn't center this enough. I mean, militarism and the status quo of US empire is so normalized and conditioned in American society that it's almost secondary. It's almost just completely absent from the discussion. There's a bipartisan foreign policy consensus. And even when you're talking about the Squad, you rarely hear people question the notion that we are an empire and that we need to be a global empire. No one talks about closing bases around the world, the 800 to 1,000 military bases. No one talks about the impact those bases have around the world. I mean, I remember I was at COP26 and I asked leading Democratic politicians who are supposed to be climate change advocates about the fact that militarism is exempt from these climate treaties. And their answers were so dystopian. Their answers were, well, look, they've just conceded the notion that climate change is the worst is coming. There's no way to stave off the worst. And so we actually need a bigger military to deal with the impacts of climate change. We need to increase our militarism. And that's the solution to climate change, Ash. So we have a fundamental problem in our society where we're not addressing and linking all of these struggles together and actually putting anti-militarist work at the forefront and the destructive nature of US foreign policy. Because when you're spending, I mean, as Martin Luther King aptly said, I mean, I'm going to butcher the quote, but like in so many words, if you're spending this much money on militarism and not on programs of social uplift, you are reaching a death of your system, the death blow of US imperialism and US empire. And that's where our country's heading. I mean, half the people of this country don't have enough money to pay other than just, they're just living paycheck to paycheck. They have no money in savings, right? They're one accident away from becoming homeless. I mean, this is insanity. This is insanity. And the ruling class just pretends like everything is great. They're living in a completely detached reality from the core amount of people who are just suffering day to day. And why is that? Why is that? Because all of our money is being funneled into death and destruction and weapons and subjugating tens of millions of people around the world. It's suffocating not only the planet, but us here at home. We don't have the avenues to change anything because the system is designed to squash any sort of activism or momentum. So I would say, yes, I mean, the biggest problem with the left is how, not only how disenfranchised it is by design, but how separate it is, right? How separate all of these movements are, how we're not connecting it to the same source of the problem, which I think obviously US capitalism, but by extension, US imperialism, you know, I mean, which is used to uphold US capitalism. That's what it is used to do, and to uphold fossil fuel infrastructure around the world as we're reaching cataclysmic effects of climate change. So I think centering US foreign policy, centering US wars, I mean, if you just point to the average voter on the street, you know, foreign policy is looked at like, oh, as kind of a background issue. And even though I said, yeah, it's very normalized and the military machine's very worshipped, it has been kind of centered in the elections ever since the war on terror. I mean, Obama got into office because he wanted to end the wars, which he didn't do. And then you saw this groundswell of activism as a reaction to that. You had Trump saying he was the anti-war candidate. Hillary Clinton was painted as the hawk. Right. Of course, Trump did nothing but further the aims of U.S. empire and do horrific things, increase drone strikes 400%. The list goes on and on. And then Biden, the same thing. He said he wanted to end the endless wars. I think people are sick of having this perpetual warfare state. And if you ask the average voter on the street what they think, I think a lot of them, Democrat and Republican and independent, would say, this is insane. This is completely insane. And so I think centering that and linking those struggles is the answer, Ash. And that's why I do what I do.
Well, that seems to be a really good place to wrap up. And I'm glad that we were able to bring it full circle back to your work and why you do what you do. Abby Martin, thank you so much for joining us on Downstream.
Thanks so much for having me, Ash. It was great.
Support independent journalism and set up a regular donation to Navara Media from just £1 a month. Head to navara.media/support.